Good afternoon, everyone. I call this Committee on Human Service Finance to order. We've got a quorum present. I would like to ask Lee New Greenlee if you'll move the minutes for January 12th.
I'd like to move the minutes for January 12th.
Representative New Greenlee moves the approval of the minutes for January 12th. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for January 12th, 2023 are now adopted. With that, members, we have Commissioner Huffstead, who will be walking us through some of the information on Human Services DHS 101. Commissioner, welcome to the Human Services Finance. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Jody Harpstead, the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Great to be with you here today to do an introductory session here on what we call DHS 101, give you a little background on the department and where things stand right now today. So as we go into the second term, our mission hasn't changed. The Department of Human Services, working with many others, helps people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. We do have a new employee vision statement, though, that when all employees are embraced, respected, and heard, we will build a collaborative, equitable, inclusive, and anti-racist culture where we all thrive. Some basics about the department. According to a recent consulting firm analysis that we've engaged in the last couple of years, Minnesota ranks high for involvement of the legislature. Some state legislatures pass broad statutes, leaving state agencies to do rulemaking to shape their work. Almost everything that governs our work is in statutes, so working together closely is imperative in Minnesota. Minnesota is one of 10 states, actually 11, and you may know this, that are state-funded, county and tribal-administered for the delivery of human services. So as we roll out programs approved by the legislature, we need to implement them through 87 counties and 11 tribal nations. In other words, it's complicated, and mistakes can happen. In our office of the commissioner today, we have a deputy commissioner for agency effectiveness, Shireen Gandhi. Some of you knew our deputy commissioner, Chuck Johnson, who was in state government for over 35 years, who retired last summer. Shireen took on most of his duties, some of them a year before he left and some of them last summer. So she now has finance compliance, service transformation, which we used to call IT, process improvement, and the Office of Equity for DHS operations. And now we call that group agency effectiveness. And we have all of our control functions, if you will, in one place. Our Deputy Commissioner for Agency Culture and Relations is Nikki Farrago, who has our legislative, county, tribal, community, and federal relations groups, communications, employee culture, which also houses our HR department, and the Office of Equity and Inclusion for the entire agency. Chief of Staff Stacy Twite does whatever needs to be done every day, all the time. And then our General Counsel, Amy Akbai. The policy administrations across DHS include our healthcare administration, run by Assistant Commissioner Cynthia McDonald, who is also the State Medicaid Director. Tiki Brown, Assistant Commissioner, has children and families. Natasha Mers has served as the Interim Assistant Commissioner for our Aging and Disability Services, and Eric Grumdahl is our Assistant Commissioner for Behavioral Health, Housing, and Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services. Our Direct Care and Treatment Services are run by Marshall Smith, our Health System CEO. Direct Care and Treatment is a specialized behavioral health system for those others cannot or will not serve in the state of Minnesota. DCT serves 12,000 patients annually, has 5,000 employees, and if you want to think about it, it's about the size of the CentraCare health system in central Minnesota housed inside DHS. It includes 12 inpatient psychiatric facilities. The largest are the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and the Forensic Mental Health Program in St. Peter, 5 inpatient substance use disorder treatment facilities, the nation's largest secure sex offender treatment program in Moose Lake and St. Peter, outpatient medical, psychiatric, and special care dental services, and group homes, vocational programs, and crisis services for more than 400 people with disabilities. They recently passed the first of four steps on the way to achieving the National Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award, which is usually a corporate award, and I understand that if they achieve that anytime soon, they'll be the first state agency in the nation to achieve the Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award. Our Office of the Inspector General, under Kalani Moti, who is our Inspector General, conducts background studies to determine if a Health and Human Services worker has committed an act that disqualifies them from providing care, monitors compliance with licensing laws and rules, investigates maltreatment and licensing violations, audits and investigates provider and recipient fraud, waste, and abuse in public programs administered by DHS. And in recent activities, is refocusing program integrity on preventing and predicting financial fraud, waste, and abuse, starting with proactive, data-driven, equitable approaches in the Child Care Assistance Program, and transforming the child care licensing system and modernizing child care licensing regulations. In this second term, starting here in January, our goal going forward, we intend to be as trustworthy to the people of Minnesota for doing our work in a more flexible and responsive fashion as we are to the taxpayers of Minnesota to have a solid approach to accounting for funds spent, especially through an ongoing workforce shortage. Some recent issues that you've probably heard about. We know that there are high behavior patients in hospitals who no longer meet hospital level of care. A couple of weeks ago, we pulled together a group of folks representing hospitals, nursing homes, group homes, Hennepin County, for example, and our direct care and treatment services to talk about this issue. We asked each group to bring their three favorite ideas for what could be done about this crisis. We collected them all up, sent them back out. We've asked them to rank them. We're going to process the rankings, come back and meet again, and you should expect to see some results out of that group coming back to you for consideration in session about the things we can do in the short term to make the situation better. And some look forward to some of the longer-term things that would also relieve the situation.
Commissioner, who are the stakeholders in that group that have been convened to talk about how we address the high-behavior patients and those who should be placed in a different setting?
Well, so far we've had members of the Minnesota Hospital Association staff who've also met with their members and collected their ideas. Then the ARM for the group homes and leading age and care providers for the nursing homes. We had Hennepin County staff there and our direct care and treatment management group.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed. Mm-hmm.
Some of you have heard about our CCBHC, Integrated Behavioral Health and Health Clinics. Minnesota was one of the pioneers in the CCBHC integrated care model. It's a beautiful model of helping people with both their health care and their behavioral health needs in one place. As we've been working with the demonstration project with the federal government, they've been moving toward ending the demonstration and moving the clinics into a normal state Medicaid plan payment approach. This last year, we were told they were going to end the demo and head for that state plan approach to payment. So we got all ready to do that when at the last minute, the federal government announced that they were going to extend the demo. Looking at the pros and cons, we decided it was best to move forward into the Medicaid state plan, a long-term sustainable source of funding. But having done that, we've gotten a lot of pushback from providers and others in the community, and so we're reconsidering that decision. Working this week to meet with several of the clinics particularly affected by it, and then others in the community, and we'll take another look at the decision and decide what to do next. And some of you read in the paper over the weekend about our mobile crisis grants that did not get out in time for January 1st. The one saving grace of this particular grant is it's a quarterly payment, and so we expect to get these contracts out again by the end of January so that the providers can sign them, and then we will be paying them as expected at the end of March. So we don't expect anyone to lose any money. It's a little nerve-wracking doing the work without a signed contract. We appreciate that, but we think this one will be all right in the end. And then fraud has certainly been in the air here in Minnesota with the findings from Feeding Our Future. And we've been taking a look at any of the folks that have been engaged in that work to see what engagement they might have in DHS work and moving as quickly as we can to see what we need to learn about that. We are also bringing forward a statute, a statutory language that would allow us to move more quickly when there's fraud in a different state agency. Our work over the years has been really focused on fraud in our own services found by our own staff. And so now to deal with fraud in a different agency is taking something, and we are looking for statutory language that would allow all agencies of state government to move more quickly when fraud is found in another part of state government. So stay tuned for that.
Commissioner, there's a question from Lee Newbrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I really appreciate your last point on the fraud and that you are working to see if there's any crossover. I couldn't help but notice, and her name has escaped me now, the woman who formed Feeding Our Future, that she was very engaged in CCAP prior to that. So I had wondered if there might be crossover. So I really appreciate hearing that. I'm wondering if you can talk to us just for a minute about the mobile crisis grants, and I'm sure it's been a stressful week or two on that front, and I appreciate that you are getting those out. Can you just talk to us for a minute about what went wrong there and what is happening to fix that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, sorry, it's Taryn Hoare and Rep. Brindley. We are going to talk more in this presentation about the capacity of our Behavioral Health Division, which needs shoring up, for one. And for two, we're also working on reorganizing the department, and this one fell through the cracks at the end of December. We're very sorry that happened. We need to do better as we work to develop a really strong and resilient department there. But this one happened this way. And again, the one saving grace of it is it's one that's paid quarterly, and we think we can put it all back together again before the first quarterly payments are due.
Any follow-up? Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Harstad. So there's some scuttlebutt around the Capitol on a proposal that might be coming forward that drug users, currently, you know, if you're on illicit drugs, that you would be kicked off of certain programs. And the scuttlebutt around the Capitol is that drug tests can still occur but would have no negative effects on individuals. Could you just let me know if that is true, and if it is true, where that's coming from, if all sanctions are going to be removed?
Chair Noor.
I think this is in regards to, is it MFIP or is it any other program?
MFIP, SNAP.
Mm-hmm. Also, in terms of individuals, I've got a bill, and we'll talk more about that. So removing some of the barriers on MFIP participants who really need substance use disorder treatment. And maybe that's where the connection between the two comes together. I think we can put a pin on that question.
So Mr. Chair, so it's not a department-led issue. It's a Representative Noor-led issue. Is that correct?
We've been discussing, Representative Francis, we've been discussing that issue because there are individuals who certainly need the assistance because they are experiencing substance use disorder. And for us to deny them the benefits that they need so they may not follow through the programs. We'll have more conversation on that. I think it goes to children and families because MFIP resides there. But we'll talk more about that program. I'll come and talk to you.
Oh, perfect.
All right.
Can I ask one more question, Representative Noor?
One more question.
Okay, thank you. So back to the fraud, Commissioner Harstad, and I certainly do appreciate the some basics about DHS that mistakes can happen, right? We've seen a lot of mistakes under DHS and a lot of money that have gone out the door under mistakes. Where are we on the waste, fraud, and abuse with the flow chart that we saw a number of years ago after the $100 million allegation fraud? And then we had this nice flow chart of how fraud was going to be stopped, and then we have the fast forward, the feeding our fraud, I mean the feeding our future scenario with what was it, $500 million, and some of those individuals that the Star Tribune reporter, Jeff, I can't remember his last name, pronounce his last name, but he did that nice write-up that connected the feeding our future individuals with those that were connected to childcare businesses. And so could you give us some background where we are on that? Because I believe this legislative cycle, we are going to be seeing a major increase in the child care assistance program. And so I think taxpayers want to know, are mistakes still going to happen?
Commissioner.
So, Chair Noor and Representative Franzen, first backing up to errors, we will have more in the presentation about what we're doing now about all of that, so we'll get to that. But I will say very quickly that, again, 3 years ago, we discovered the $100 million in errors, which added up to 0.1% of all of our payments over a six-year period. 3 years later, over a nine-year period, we've had no other major errors like that to report. And so I think we're doing very well with our $23 billion budget. And so we can talk more about that, and we will show you some of the things we put in place to make sure that that's the case. When it comes to the fraud connection that was in the newspaper, we have started thoroughly examining any connections between the people that were named and DHS, starting with making sure the people named were really the same people. We have to compare home addresses and things to be sure a name is really the name, and then examining what connections they may have with DHS programs, and we are in the middle of that. But we are finding that the history of our fraud work through our Office of the Inspector General has been focused on fraud in our own programs, and much of our statutory language that we have to work with is about fraud in our own programs. And so because this was such an egregious situation that everyone's read about, we are bringing statutory language to see if we can find ways to move more quickly when we know about fraud in another state program. So you'll see that come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be good for us to look at how we could help assist the different departments with sharing. As soon as you find out about a fraud or an issue, if there was an appropriate way of sharing with the same group in another entity. Yeah, I think that inspector generals tend to talk to each other, but you know how your different teams. And I think that would really make people more confident to hear that, you know, we discovered this, and within the same month, they looked into it in another area. I mean, press always is going to have the worst, but there's always the concern that it's the tip of the iceberg. And if we can have that communication, and again, maintaining the same integrity for privacy, which all the departments should have. So maybe the chair can look at with some of the members to draft some language to help enable or facilitate that activity. Thank you.
Thank you, President Quam. I think from what I've heard from the commissioner, there's a language coming through, and we'll be looking into that language. So thank you so much. Commissioner, proceed.
I want to give you an update on the COVID activity we've been doing for the last 3 years. We passed 120 waivers of rules and regulations and guidance to get counties, tribes, providers, and Minnesotans through the COVID shutdown. Each one of those decisions required approval from the people around the table that I was working with, DHS Legal, Finance, Compliance, Minute, our Equity Office, Assistant Commissioners, Subject Matter Experts, and ultimately MMB in the Governor's Office. And we also worked very closely with our legislative chairs before, during, and after those waivers. Most have now been stood back up or codified, as you know, ongoing by the legislature. The prime example everybody knows about is telemedicine, or what I used to call tele-everything, as we learned during the COVID early days. The big project ahead this year is the county and tribe recertification of recipient eligibility for Medicaid and Minnesota Care, which will start in April of 23 and end in March of 24. The usual annual recertification volume, this is a process that always happens annually for Medicaid and Minnesota Care. The usual recertification volume was about 1.2 million people a year. The post-COVID volume is 1.5 million people because the federal government required us for matching. Are we looking at some wrong pages or something?
We don't have this
page. I think we don't have that page, but I think some of us can see from here the most.
Yeah.
But okay. I think we'll get that page to the members.
I wonder if it's in the wrong order.
No. It's on the website this way. I have
Yeah.
It.
Yep.
All right. Okay. Do you want me to continue as I was? Thank you. Because the federal government required us to keep people who were on Medicaid throughout COVID in order to qualify for matching federal funds, we now have 1.5 million people on Medicaid post-COVID. And so this will be a bigger project than it has been in the past for our county and tribal staff. And in the past, and when things are normal, recertification is done every year. So if a person changed address, or they had a child, or their income changed, they would do an update every year and keep going. Now their data is 3 years old because we haven't been doing recertification for the last 3 years. So it's going to be a really big project in all 50 states in this next year. So you're hearing about that coming up now. We've had a project team on it for some time. They keep moving the date back, so it's allowed us even more time for planning to prepare for this project to support our county and tribal partners in their work. We have an enormous communication campaign going on to remind Minnesotans who need to be recertified that, A, they need to be recertified, and, B, they need to make sure their county has their address so they can get the mailings they will need to tell them when to come in and how to do that. And now we've brought in Deloitte, who is consulting with us, looking at our plan, giving us suggestions from other states on how to shore up the plan. And they are one of the central organizations that's working across several states who are all doing the same project at the same time. So we have a plan going forward for this and ready to kick it off in April, and you'll hear a lot about that this year. Is this your next slide?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. So I want to talk a bit about DHS capacity. From 2018 to 2022, our overall budget grew by 30%, while our office staff grew by 2%. Our Medicaid budget grew by 31%, while our staff declined by 2.74%. Let me quickly show you why. This is the behavioral health contracts that we processed every year for the last several years, and you can see this enormous balloon of money that came in during COVID, federal and state, and then our state surpluses for the last couple of years. I'm sorry that we didn't anticipate the pandemic, but we didn't, and so we couldn't gear up for it, and so we've been working to keep up ever since. As a result, usual formulas for putting FTEs in individual bills, as we've used them over the years, did not keep up with our need to staff HR, finance, compliance, and legal, and our workforce shortage doesn't help either. So expect requests for additional staffing this session to get our funding back to where it belongs so that we can get funding out to providers as soon as possible after the session.
We have a question from New Friendly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. You know, we heard last week that there were 388 staff positions that were appropriated for in bills, but only 41 of those were filled. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about sort of the disconnect there. With, you know, why we are hearing that the legislature allocated for much, much more, I mean, many times more than what has actually been filled, and how that might affect this. I mean, it seems like perhaps the legislature has done its job in providing for those FTEs, but they've not been filled. And so what has happened with those resources that were allocated for FTEs? And what is the solution here?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Rep. Brindley, there's always some of that every year in terms of allocations of FTEs that don't get filled by the end of the year for all kinds of reasons. I can tell you that even if we filled every one of those this year, we would be short on the number of people we really think we should have on an ongoing basis. So I don't want to have that data take away from the point we're making that we need a stronger capacity to handle the kinds of money that we're dealing with. Some of it is that some of the positions that are unfilled are not in the same spaces as the ones that I'm talking about, where we need to get the right people to do the work. But some of that happens every year. And so we can talk kind of more about that whole question as we go forward. It's a good question. And we're not saying that the legislature has in any way failed to give us the resources that we need. I'm just saying that all of the federal and state money that's come our way in the last couple of years caught us all off guard, and we've been scrambling to keep up. And now we have a better handle on what we think we really need to be strong enough to get the dollars out the door, and would like to talk more about this throughout this session. So we can bring more information about the unfilled positions if that's also helpful to hear about.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, and thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. And you and I had talked about that prior to session, and I appreciate that. I have to say, and thank you, Rep. Fisher, for the clarification on that question. I was shocked to hear those numbers last week. That is a really significant discrepancy when we have allocated 388 and only 41 were filled. And I certainly understand the issue that, you know, they're not necessarily in the same area. But 343 is a lot of positions. And so either those resources are still set aside for this staffing, or those resources are being used elsewhere. We need to have a better handle on that. I hope that as a committee, we will really scrutinize that issue and not just say, okay, well, clearly we need 1,000 more FTEs when we're not even filling what's been allocated. Thank you.
Thank you, Lead New Brindley. I think we will follow up on some of those needs, and maybe we'll be doing some shifting, and we'll see what will come to our committee. So, Commissioner.
Thank you. This goes back to the conversation around some of the errors that we found 3 years ago in the department, and we want you to get a sense here of the did I skip one? No, there. Our contract integration system. The contract integration system moves our contracts and grants work into the 21st century by converting the work from a paper to an electronic system for the first time in state history on a system called Agile Apps, not a decades-old mainframe system. I think of it as operating like the online ordering applications that keep telling you you can't push your order until you complete all the required fields, including your email twice, for example. And it saves all the documentation in a central location, organized by grant category, date of the work, and who completed the steps. And over time, we're optimistic that will allow us to pull some sort of macro data to show compliance levels, speed of the work, number of times certain steps are problematic, where we can make some changes, equity in grant making, et cetera. The contract integration system is now in place in our behavioral health division. We have about 70% of the agency on the contract integration system, and we're working to complete all of that work and get everyone on it as soon as possible. This finally gives our employees the tools they need to make fewer mistakes, to be sure that they are putting everything in one central location, that they're answering all the questions they need to answer before issuing a grant. And so we're excited about the possibilities of this really making us error-free going forward. We are also talking about subtraction. You've heard us talk about this many times in the last year, looking for additional opportunities to reduce the number of contracting and grant-making steps and the length of time it takes to get money out the door. So you may have heard my recent testimony that said we have 85 steps to go from an RFP all the way through to the end of a contract. And we have already reduced that number to 73 steps for a regular RFP. And by the full implementation of the contract integration system, we'll cut another 10 to 12 steps of the process, resulting in almost a 30% reduction in the number of steps necessary to get grants out the door without compromising accountability and oversight. So as I've been saying for the last 3 years, our staff needs tools to do a good job of moving more quickly, being accurate, and then keeping all of their documentation in one place. We've also completed the work to put up a Medicaid decision-making initiative, a new Medicaid decision-making initiative, which is establishes decision-making authority, approval requirements, and clear accountability for new Medicaid policy adoption, changes to policy, and fiscal impacts. So it assigns formal decision-making authority to our state Medicaid director. It actually mirrors what we did with the COVID waivers. It brings together key leaders and subject matter experts around the table to discuss a specific decision, and when everyone agrees that, yes, that's the right way to go, we make the decision. establishes clear roles and definitions in changing and implementing processes and a formal documented decision-making process, also using the Agile Apps database. This would eliminate in the future what happened in the past when someone said, yeah, that feels about right. Why don't you do it that way? It makes people come together to say, is that really the right way Medicaid wants us to do this? Is this the right approach for Minnesota? And we won't make a decision about a new payment process until everyone agrees that it's the correct decision. In the fall, we brought our senior leaders together to imagine our biggest possibilities for the next 4 years. It's a construct that we use in our work. We ask people to imagine their biggest possibilities before we rewrite our strategic plan and before we set our one-year plans in place. So a biggest possibility is something that would be amazing, and it's one that would happen if everything went right. So it's not the plan, it's not what we promised to deliver, but it's a possibility. And so we just wanted to share with you what we see as the biggest possibilities for the people we support. One is to develop a short, powerful set of metrics of disparity, such as income, employment, housing, longevity, hospital admissions. Build equity into the walls of DHS and see those metrics move over time. This was an idea we borrowed from the CDC, who has a very short list of disparity metrics like this, and whatever work they do, they're going back to see if it made a difference in any of these key metrics. We're interested in demoing new population-specific healthcare models like IHP and population-specific total cost of care models, which marry healthcare with social services in a really good way where we can calculate the impact that they have on each other and make sure that people get what they need and, as a result, better health through the combination of social service and health care. We're looking to expand mental health and addiction facility capacity, as we were talking earlier, and integrate behavioral health strategies with housing strategies, and now that those are in the same place. And then with our colleagues in the Interagency Council on Homelessness to take a stand for racial justice, gender justice, housing justice, and health justice. We're interested in initiating work to make Minnesota the best place for all children, including Black, Brown, and Indigenous children to grow up, and at the same time to keep Minnesota in the top 5 states nationwide for older adults and people with disabilities to live in. We're interested in demonstrating new models for older adults and people with disabilities to live in integrated settings in a workforce shortage. Removing unnecessary barriers to patient progress through the sex offender program and other civilly committed DCT services, and to reduce our carbon footprint with fewer and solar-powered buildings, electric fleets, and an educated workforce. Some of the biggest possibilities we see for our partners in the human services system: to develop robust approaches to co-creating our work with community, to know who gets our grants across the agency and move that measurement to those who most need our services to live full lives in community. Building out our systems and processes to create a seamless, state-funded, county, tribal-administered, full human services system. We've spent a lot more time in recent years in meetings with county and tribal leaders, understanding how we can work together better to have that seamless process across the state. As I said before, subtracting unnecessary rules and regulations that don't impact health and safety or prevent fraud or abuse for a time of workforce shortage. Our partners in counties and tribes are going to have trouble keeping up with all the rules and regulations we have in a workforce shortage, so let's do the minimum that meet the requirements. Becoming a systems product organization committed to the integration of human services. The best example of this is the MN benefits process for signing up for benefits. We now have a process where people can go in and in 12 minutes sign up for 9 benefits in a way that's much more responsive and flexible and easier to use, and we have hopes and dreams to do that in many other places in DHS, and to make all of our work widely accessible to all Minnesotans. And finally, for DHS possibilities inside the department, we want to improve our capacity as a flexible, agile, responsive customer service organization, lock in trustworthiness with our compliance plan, Medicaid decision-making process, and contract integration system, achieve that Malcolm Baldrige Award for DCT, move to the fifth or sixth pillar of our anti-racism multicultural continuum, and accelerate progress in the inclusion of the LGBTQIA2S plus community, veterans, and people with disabilities, and work toward the realization of our employee vision statement, making DHS a best place to work and to develop careers, promoting from within whenever possible.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we'll pause there and start with some few questions here. We'll start with the Representative Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on number 11 in the handout, we had you showing behavioral division, number of contracts, and personnel growth. What's given, I assume, is actual FTEs. It'd be nice to have this with the budgeted FTEs above it. That would give us maybe some context to what was happening. And on the same thing here with your basically number of contracts versus a person, I was trying to figure out when some of the software upgrades kicked in over the years, which would have impacted the productivity, decreased the cycle time. And it'd be nice if we had an idea of the progress on that. Some years ago, I was drafting a bill to try and upgrade, because you've got such a patchwork, and to create a portal so that both people looking at what assistances were out there in programs, plus the county personnel, which sometimes they're not really sure. So you have a portal that they could, and you've got a bit of that portal that's been developing in the last few years, so they can see what they are, because not all the parameters around qualification match between the different services, and that complexity is tough for the people trying to help and also the people looking. So it'd be nice if we had an understanding of the progress in that portal and the accessibility, and then if it's rolled out just to department personnel, just to counties, you know, what progress that is, because you're going to be constrained with hiring people to help.
Right.
And what the rest of the world's done is productivity tools, and it's been a long time since outside of government people have had green screens, and we still have green screens in government. The other question I had was, in general, percent of budget not spent in the different areas, and then percent of FTEs open in the different areas. That would help us as we're creating, you know, budgeting and filling of, you know, is it that we're not able to hire the people and that's where the extra money is, or is it because, well, some of our surplus is because the feds paid and we've had that extra money. So we understand creating a new post-pandemic budget.
Yep.
Where things are sitting, and maybe how the mix would be composed. And then with the Inspector General, maybe an idea of the different initiatives that they brought and you're rolling in. That communication would help us understand what's happening and be hopefully more reassured that progress is being made in different areas. But if not, it might help us to do some enabling language to assist in the development and support.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Plum. I think we should all agree that this is the year that we should end the mainframe system, the green screen that we've been talking about, but also know more about the contract integration system and how that is improving the productivity and some of the challenges in transitioning from one system to the other. I think you have asked a lot of questions in that process. Did you want to do a follow-up? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is some touching in the presentation on decreasing the cycle time and get rid of the redundancies. And I think that if there's offline additional documentation, because amongst the people that are part of this body, there's some background in different areas. And somebody might see, well, oh, 4 years ago we did this and it really helped. And that's why we have the diversity in the House to be able to have all these different views on a topic, but if we don't have the information from the department, we won't get that, and the apple won't hit our heads. Thank you.
Thank you. Any response, Commissioner?
Chair Noren and Representative, just thank you for that perspective. And I think the more the committee can learn about the details of our work and how it works and where the problems are, then we can make good decisions about how to shore it up and move it forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner and Representative Plum, for centering on the why we do things the way we do. I've got Lee Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. If we can go back to slide 15, that was the Medicaid decision-making initiative. Mm-hmm. And you said specifically you're bringing together key leaders and subject matter experts. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you are involving at all caregiver input or user input as you make those decisions as well. I think you and I had a discussion, and certainly not involving Medicaid, but involving Medicare, I've had a lot of experience that makes my head explode mm-hmm. and makes me say, okay, I can see why we've got problems in the cost of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how you are engaging with caregivers and users of the Medicaid system to find out what their experience mm-hmm. is and what they see as areas that we can do better.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner.
Yep, Chuck Noor and Rep. Brindley, we have continuous communications with the hospitals and with providers of disability services and nursing facilities, et cetera, to understand their concerns and some of their issues. And then this process comes along when there's a specific decision to be made about how to pay for something, and then this decision table would be the people that come together inside the department to make a really good legal decision about where things are. But we have plenty of opportunities throughout the year to talk with folks in all of the different kinds of facilities that we support with the Medicaid program. And I think we're doing a better job than ever of talking to the community and not doing things in an insular way inside the department. But you can always get better at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. I do appreciate that. I would just encourage, as you go through this process and as you find ways to engage, it's not always the folks in the facilities who are experiencing it the same way as families experience things. And where there are families who are interacting with Medicaid, I suspect that they might have a very different perspective than hospitals or other facilities and the way they would interact with it. I would really encourage trying to find a way to engage more with those folks who are interacting with the system, like I said, outside of a more institutional setting, because they probably would have a very different perspective than even those kinds of providers, of caregivers.
Mm-hmm. Good point, Lee Newburn. I think we need to take the perspective from the families and also the recipients in terms of how we're doing how our system really works. So, if you don't have any other follow-up, I'd wonder if you bring Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. This is going back to the recertification. One of the things I know that you're struggling with is trying to get names out there. One of the positives I've seen with the recertification not having been done, I've talked to providers who are in the who've got clinics who are serving primarily homeless people. Their uninsured rate has dropped by anywhere from 1/2 to 1/3 because when the people got covered, they continued coverage because they're so mobile, it's hard to get them recertified. So, on any given night, we've got 6,000 youth who are mm-hmm. homeless. So how do we make sure that they continue the process? Because what ends up happening is that when they fall off, that means they're still going to get cared, but the communities, clinics that are doing this work, which are already very stretched because they don't have the a large population of commercial insurance, they end up having a ton more charity care, and they start going into models where they may not be financially viable anywhere. So what is your thoughts of how do we approach the homeless situation, those who are experiencing homelessness, to try to make sure that coverage continues and that they're getting recertified? I think that's going to be probably one of the biggest issues we're facing.
Commissioner.
Chair Knorr and Rep. Fisher, that's a very good question. It's always been difficult to serve the homeless population, keep in touch with them, make sure they know what their options are when they may not have an address or a permanent address. I've seen tools and things people have used with handing out cell phones so they could stay in touch that way. And we do know that the majority of Minnesotans today do have smartphones, and we can find ways to find them that way. I think we're going to have to rely a lot on the organizations that serve them now and have solved some of these problems and figured out how to stay in touch. We're going to have to be sure that there's an overall communication plan so that the general public knows that if you're on Medicaid, you need to get recertified. I know that we are using some of the techniques and some of the points of contact that we used during COVID to tell underserved communities about testing and masks and vaccines. And so we're using some of those touch points to find people. But I think we're going to particularly have to rely on the providers that serve the homeless population to tell them that they need to check back in and that we need to have a good conversation there. So that's going to be one of the toughest, as it always has been, to stay in touch with and make sure they're served.
Jeffy.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, and thank you, Commissioner. Yeah, the earlier work that we can get word out to those that are working with the homeless communities, probably the better, because I could see in some instances that the uninsured rate will jump 2 to 3 times where it is right now for those who've got insurance coverage. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. So we'll be taking a deep dive into the renewal process as we see the plan coming forward. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Going to need you to elaborate a little bit on initiate work to make Minnesota the best place for all children, including Black, Brown, and Indigenous children, to grow up. What exactly is your plan to do that? Because the work that I've done with you all, I feel like doesn't necessarily align with that statement. So I'm interested to hear. I see that's like on the very last page. It's one of your big takeaways. And so just really interested to see that, especially because you haven't addressed the concerns that we have regarding ICWA in this entire presentation, when you know that that's a pretty extreme situation that we're dealing with that you all have oversight
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Knorr and Rep. Keeler. Our plan is to continue to make this commitment part of every single thing we do. We don't have a specific set of objectives for making that our work. But we do know that we need to go beyond talking about whether Minnesota is a good place for children and make sure it's a good place for all children. So that's the point of that biggest possibility. And so we need to continue to bake that into everything that we do. So much of Medicaid is Black, Brown, and Indigenous children, and so we need to focus on their needs as we continue to work and improve the Medicaid program. And it was the top priority for us. And so we've been working with the folks that are working to shore up MIFPA this session and deep into that conversation on a regular basis and making sure that we stay engaged with that and continuing to work on ICWA compliance with our counties and all of the aspects there. ICWA training, we've had additional funding added over the last few years, and we're going to continue to do that. So ICWA is very, very high on our list of all the things that we do to make that possibility a reality.
I just find it concerning that it's nowhere. You're giving us a DHS 101 overview, and we know that Minnesota is worst in the nation for removal of Native American children, 17-1. I've said this over and over and over, and you come to our committee, and you're talking about the things that you do, and you make the statement that you want to make Minnesota the best place for all children, yet you don't necessarily want to address, because to me it's fraud, too. Fraud is not just about money. Fraud is about what you're doing with your oversight with our children. And I don't know how many more times I need to say it in this space or moving forward when you don't even address it in any of your slides. And maybe it's a slide I'm missing that's online somewhere. It's really contradicting to say that you as an organization, as an agency, want to make Minnesota the best place in the nation for Black, Brown, and Indigenous children and all children, yet you kind of refuse and turn your back on this massive issue that we have in this state. And I keep saying that. Like, if you're going to come and you're going to address issues in Minnesota and you're not going to bring up ICWA or MIFPA and you're the organization and the agency that oversees that, that's a problem. That's a problem for me. It should be a problem for everybody else here. So I think that that's a statement that you need to tape back to your agency and actually digest and, like, fix, because from what I've seen in our conversations and what our tribes are asking, we're not on a pathway to make Minnesota the best for all children. And we need to own our flaws in that, because unless we own it, we're never going to fix it. So I would just appreciate that as you enter into this space, don't fool us. We're not here to be blind by the fact that we are mistreating our indigenous children in this state. And you as an agency has got to own that in some capacity. You cannot put a 101 presentation together and not highlight one of the biggest areas of concern that we should have as a state. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Killa. We're with you, we're hearing you, and I think we have to do more when it comes to ICWA and also how we do that work. And I'm also trusting that the commissioner will be doing a full presentation in children and families, because the most of that work is also centered in children and families. So, Commissioner, do you have any comment to add on?
Chair Noor and Rep. Keeler, no, but I appreciate the issue. I certainly appreciate your feeling about it, and I appreciate that we haven't mentioned it in this presentation. It's one of the things that is a very high on our list, and we have people very much engaged with the folks that are bringing forward language to strengthen MIFPA this year and continue to work to strengthen ICWA. And yes, it's a critical element of making Minnesota a good place for all children to grow up.
Any follow-up? I'm hoping that you'll be meeting with the department to also discuss further some of the initiatives that you're working on. Thank you so much. Representative Rath.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I'd like to talk about how you're using technology to improve the operations of DHS. Coming from my background in process improvement and technology design and deployment, I looked at interest with slides 12 and 13 and have seen the ways that it can work well and the ways we can miss opportunity. And so I'm just curious how user experience design in particular has been used to create tools that work well for the people who actually have to use them, how process improvement is grounded or not in grassroots individual contributor experience, because one of the things I've seen often is managers saying, here's how they do it, which does not reflect reality at all. And I hope that we are going to the people who are performing the tasks where we're improving the processes. And I'd just like to hear a little bit more about that. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Representative. The prime example that comes to mind is this MM benefits program that we've put in place that allows people to sign up for many benefits in a few minutes. It was a project that we did in collaboration with Code for America and with our counties. And so our counties that do that work came together, and they all together worked on how to design that system. I can't say, because I don't know, that they went to the frontline workers that were literally interacting with the computer screens, but we worked very closely and designed it together to make that work. It's been held up as a national example of really high quality use of technology in government to make government easier to work with, and we continue to want to do more and more of that. I mentioned our organization chart, and our agency effectiveness group has our IT department in it. When Chuck Johnson retired this past year, we moved the fellow who was managing IT for us from MINIT, the agency that does IT, into DHS as a senior leader. He's part of our senior leadership team. And then MINIT backfilled him with another person to be the interaction with MINIT. And so we have someone who's an expert in IT right on our senior leadership team. And he was part of a project over the last several years with an outside consulting firm to make our systems easier to interact with across the state in all different ways. And we're continuing progress on that plan every single year. And so I'm pleased that we've actually brought that expertise into DHS, and I think it's going to make a big difference. MINIT also feels like it was a huge jump to put someone right in the division, in the department, who who could be a leader in that space. So we're making progress. We have big plans to continue to make progress, and I appreciate your point about how the people actually interacting with the system can tell us a lot about what it's like to get that done.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I would just add that it's important to have an ongoing feedback loop. It's not something's done and then it's done. Going forward, I hope that there are opportunities for the people, especially the ones who are actually doing the work, because it's essential. They aren't a nice to have, they're a necessary to have, and too often are not included.
Thank you so much, Representative Bryant. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Knorr and Commissioner Harbstead. You know, I've listened to this, and I appreciate your presentation. The MDH employee vision talks about employees being embraced, respected, heard, collaborative, equitable. And it just resonated to me, and how do we apply that into our settings of where we provide care? We have care settings of nursing homes, assisted livings, home care settings. We have about 1.5 million who are right now going to be recertified. That's 27% of our population that may be displaced or be having a change in eligibility at a time when we have hospitals full, bottlenecked, no placement plan. And you state it's complicated. Mistakes happen at DHS. It's complicated running a 24-hour facility. So while your paperwork and stream systems may not be all in place, it seems ironic to me that we're finding assisted livings and nursing homes at record paces. I asked that last week, and I want the data from DHS and MDH on the number of fines from 2019 before COVID to through COVID, what we have been fining our assisted livings and long-term care or disability group homes, and what is the scope and severity? Is this paperwork compliance, which you would call a mistake happens, or is this death and injury? And to be reminded that the facilities are implementing policies the state MDH set with CDC on COVID parameters of when people stay home, when they come to work. So the staffing crisis wasn't an unknown commodity. It was known. There's not a second, third line like hockey to come in. And the National Guard could not go to the thousands of assisted livings we have or nursing homes. So with that said, you know, I hope that we can get that data and look at it, because we have a statement here that Minnesota is the top five states nationwide for older adults with people, for seniors and disabilities. That is not the feedback I'm getting every day in my email or my phone calls from family members who are experiencing it, for caregivers, for seniors, for people with disabilities and clients. It is quite a different experience. And if we are going to grow a workforce, there has to be mutual respect to an aide, to a nurse, to a doctor, or they're not going to come into these settings. The work is hard. I'm not sure if you've ever been a nursing assistant, but I was as a CEO through COVID. And I have been for 40 years and 30 years in nursing home ministry. This work is tough. And so we have to ask ourselves some honest questions. We are forgiving mistakes at the top level, and we are punitively punishing people who are providing the actual care. And without caregivers, there's no care. So this affects all people of every race, of every age, of every gender, in every community we're in. And I hope we can get the data, because the fines are taking away money for food and everything else. And we need to have the data, because I'm getting asked it every day from our communities and from the caregivers. So I would appreciate a follow-up to this committee on what the numbers say and what the scope and severity is, and a breakdown. Thank you.
Thank you. I think some of these questions will go to MDH, because some of the rules apply through MDH, and hopefully we can get that response. But Commissioner, I know you have with the long-term care as the next section. As you respond to this, please proceed with also the slides, and then we can ask other questions.
Okay.
So we wanted to offer a view of the state of long-term care and the workforce for you. Lots of questions about that in general. And you all know about the aging of the population in Minnesota and the exponential growth in the number of seniors in our state. This is a look at the growth of the disability waivers and the forecast through 2025 of the growth of people on disability waivers. This shows you that over the last 25 years, people have been changing how they are served for long-term care support. Fewer people in long-term care facilities and more on waivers and with home care. This shows the same thing. The two bars on the left are nursing facilities, disability waiver, residential settings, and the other four bars are various forms of care in the home. The average wage in the caring professions is about 30% below the average Minnesota wage, and that was at the start of COVID, while the average Minnesota wage has risen at least 5.6%, and they'd have to keep updating this slide, over the past year as employers compete for workers. It's also an equity issue, as you can see, that child care workers, PCAs, and nursing assistants are disproportionately BIPOC and female on our medical assistance programs and on our SNAP food benefits. This is the chart that is from MDH. It's a survey that they do of long-term care facilities, skilled nursing facilities on the left and assisted livings on the right, asking if people are able to accept new admissions. And you can see over the course of the last year, from October of 21 to November of 22, what this looked like. And you can see that the assisted living facilities have recovered from COVID more quickly than the nursing facilities. I'm just going to skip this slide and go to this one. This is provider capacity in our group homes for people with developmental disabilities. If you look at the tall blue bar on the left, last January, we had a spike in the service terminations of individuals with disabilities out of their group home settings. And that was two large providers that closed several group homes. You can see that that blue bar, which represents 2022, each of these colored bars is a year. So the blue bars representing 2022 came down through the summer, spiked again in September, and have come down since in terms of actual service terminations. In terms of group home licenses, you can see the ups and downs here. You can see closed licenses below the center line in the cream-colored bars, and open licenses in the blue bars over the central line. And then you can see the overall active licenses each of the quarters throughout this thing. And so while we have had some group homes closed, we've had others open. And on net, they're about the same as they were back in 2019. Pressures that are getting worse. We hear stories of CEOs taking shifts in group homes or long-term care facilities, parents supplementing shifts in group homes, parents picking up their adult children for the weekend when group homes can't staff. We hear stories of quality of care, suffering with turnover and available workers, fears about the small local senior facilities closing in favor of larger providers, families having to travel distances to visit their family members. And one NEMT provider stopped picking up members of Red Lake and White Earth who are on fee-for-service MA. Most providers who talk about closing or going out of business are more likely to turn over their services to another provider. There are providers looking to open or acquire services in Minnesota because of our above-average payment structures. I believe we need a rich mix of service models to allow people choice and models tailored to individuals instead of everyone in nursing homes, all in group homes, or all in home care. And we need to map our service locations and strive to have services close to home for as many Minnesotans as possible. The legislature enacted value-based reimbursement for nursing facilities in 2015. Nursing facilities in Minnesota are paid for most of their costs over time. Given that generous reimbursement commitment, they are paid 18 to 24 months after incurring those costs and after their cost reports have been audited for allowable costs.
While the delay in payment can certainly create cash flow challenges, in 2023, the extra costs incurred during COVID and as a result of the workforce shortage are catching up with that VBR model. The November forecast projects that automatic annual rate increases for nursing homes under VBR will result in a $279 million additional revenue for nursing homes in the next biennium. Just to show you, before you start talking about different bill proposals, what's already in the forecast. And back to our biggest possibilities to initiate work to make Minnesota the best place for all children, including Black, Brown, and Indigenous children to grow up, and keeping Minnesota in the top five states nationwide for older adults and people with disabilities to live in.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know this. We'll start with Representative Franson.
I'm good.
You're good? Lead Newbin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I'm hoping you can talk to us a little bit more about the nursing facility VBR forecast. I know that there's this increase in the $279 million, but as we hear over and over and over again, the crisis is not inflammatory, right? I mean, it is a legitimate crisis where we are seeing facilities close their doors. And so while that's the forecast number, is your belief, is the department's belief that is going to be sufficient, or will we still need to do some additional things and offer some additional funding for our long-term care facilities to ensure that they continue to operate?
It's a very I'm sorry, Chair Noor. And Representative Brindley, that's a very good question and hard to know for sure. And you know, hard to pick an exact number in terms of what would make the biggest difference or how much is enough. And so I'm sure we'll be talking about that throughout the session. I just wanted to put this out there so you know what was already in the forecast, as you also imagine what bills to bring forward for supporting this sector.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As just a follow-up, and do you have a good assessment of what, I mean, obviously we know that the VBR is behind. I mean, like you said, it's the 18 to 24 months. Do you have a sense of how this will impact the current costs? As we know, inflation has been significantly difficult for our long-term care facilities who are purchasing under current prices but being reimbursed for prices from a long time ago that are no longer accurate. Presumably that $279 million is in part to help offset that. So do you have a sense of what those increased costs have been for facilities so that we can start to wrap our heads around what the real needs are?
Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Noor and Rep. Brindley, we will have to hear from the nursing facilities talking to us about their current costs and how inflation has affected them. Our cost reporting is from the couple of years ago, year and a half ago, and that's all the data that we have. We have far more cost data on nursing facilities than any place else because they do report all their costs to us, but delayed. And so the industry itself, I think, will have to give us a really good view of where they're standing right now.
Last question. Thank you, Chair Noor. Can you explain to us a little bit? I mean, I know that the reimbursement is significantly delayed. Is the reporting also that delayed? Do you not have any more current information from those long-term care facilities? Or I should maybe just ask, what is the most recent data that you have under that reporting?
Commissioner.
Yep, Chair Noor and Rep. Brindley. So we just finished analyzing the cost reporting for most of the nursing homes here at the end of 2022 to set their 2023 rates at this level. And so this next year we'll be collecting their data from 18 to 24 months before that and making their decision on the 24 rate. And so we are also, our data that we have is the 18 to 24 month delay from their actual costs.
Thank you.
One more follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just encourage folks to look at this. I mean, the VBR really is significantly delayed. And with the inflation costs across the board in the state, this has had a huge impact on our long-term care facilities beyond the workforce shortage, beyond being able to just care for people. Everything has become more expensive, from the cost of supplies to the cost of
electricity to run the homes, the cost of natural gas to heat the homes or the group homes or the nursing home facilities. And so I suspect that this $279 million that really is based on old data is going to be a drop in the bucket. So I hope that we consider that moving forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lead Newbrinley. We will have more deep dive and discussion, and I think Chair Fisher, you.
I'm sorry to interrupt here, but thank you, Chair Noor, and building off Newbrinley. The question is, we should also be looking at is, you know, we're looking at data that is old. Is that spelled out in statute or is that spelled out in rule? And I ask because it makes a difference how we approach the issue. If somebody has an answer on us, that might help guide us.
Commissioner, I sense that there is a need for grounding this committee on the how the VBR really works and mm-hmm. how it impacts the long-term care, and specifically for the nursing homes,
mm-hmm.
and how the $279 million revenue in the focus. Members, you should know that this is focused in the system, but we make those decisions based on what we do here. So, Commissioner, I think we will have to do a deep dive mm-hmm. in terms of that process, mm-hmm. but if you wanted to have a follow-up on whether it's already defined in the statute.
I'm not actually sure of that, so I'll have to ask myself about how that's been determined.
Commissioner, we have the House Research Analyst, Ms. Nguyen.
Chair and members, in Minnesota statutes, Chapter 256R is where all of the governing language for VBR is, and that lays out the reporting requirements and the timing and also the formula for how the nursing facilities are paid.
Thank you so much, Ms. McGann. I think we got the response, and we need to have more discussion on this issue, and I assure you we'll have.
Can I have one comment on this?
We'll do. We'll give you the last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I was just going to add, just historically, this was that delayed payment was sort of compromised language when this was first negotiated
yeah.
to sort of offset a significant increase all at once. And so they put in that delayed payment, which now obviously has a huge impact. I mean, we don't usually see the kind of inflation that we are seeing now. So it's had a much more significant impact than it has in the past, but that is amplified right now.
Good to note that, but I think also they will get paid. Nothing will be deducted based on they will be sending their they'll be getting their reimbursement based on the information that the department gets. So, Commissioner, do you have one final follow-up on that, or we can skip that?
No.
I have Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. Just real quick, Commissioner, question on, again, it's the second time we've read it in here, and I appreciate the feedback the representative posted earlier or visited about. To initiate work to make Minnesota the best place for all children, including black, brown, and indigenous children, to grow up. And I just want to ask you, at what point in the child's life does that happen? Is it to provide opportunities for the birth, you know, the moms, you know, for the babies in utero or after they're born? How do you see that happening?
I was thinking primarily, I'm sorry, Chair Noor and Representative, I'm thinking primarily about children born.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, so there will be no work then for the mothers that are carrying black, brown, and indigenous children.
Well, as a matter of fact, Chair Noor and Representative, we also have several initiatives that we've worked on in the last couple of years for healthy pregnancies, and so I should not forget that. And that's been another piece of our work that's made some difference here.
And thank you, Commissioner, for mentioning that. We extended the postpartum period to 12 months so that we can take care of moms, especially those who have had their babies. It used to be only 60 days and you're done. And I think we're glad to have worked on that. Thank you for the leadership that you took to make it 12 months. And did you have a follow-up?
Okay, I appreciate that. I just want to know, at what point does that start?
So I think the commissioner's response for every kid is included in there, including their parents, because we're providing them the support in children, families, and the DHS. So it includes moms and their kids from the early stages.
So when they're pregnant? if they're a part of that, then that process.
I think based on the response from the commissioner, that's yes. When a mother needs help, we do have all those other programs, WIC program and so many things that go also to the Department of Health. And so, Commissioner, did you want to do a follow-up?
No.
I'll give you a fair representative. Do you have any follow-ups?
No,
you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when we're talking about nursing homes and senior care, because of all the issues we've gotten, there have been some new mixes, such as townhomes set up for seniors with Meals on Wheels, and arrangements for a nursing staff and others to come through and help. It's not a regular nursing home. It's a stage of where they're able to stay out in a residence. I've seen apartment complexes in southern Minnesota where they have people come through. They've got a service to provide some of the nursing assistance, but not the level of nursing homes. And so I wonder if you've got some background on these introductory things that are impacting the people that can't, a lot of nursing homes you can't get into. And so the alternatives that are popping up and how we can help facilitate working with different programs and et cetera with them. And then also, what are we looking at that other states are doing that we might be able to plagiarize to help with the issue?
Thank you, President Baum. I think you mentioning the group homes combining with PCA and different kind of programs that are available to individuals and elderly and disabled. I think it's something that the department will be looking into. In fact, we'll be talking more about how we address those needs and how they can interact very well with, I think the commission also mentioned the hospital's decompression and also looking in how we can help with the DCT, which is right now at full capacity. So, Commissioner, do you have any comment on that?
Yes, Chair Noor and Representative, just to say that in the recent meeting where we had gathered people from all over the caring sectors to talk about solutions, we often heard an idea about something between the larger facilities and home care as a necessary ingredient of the work that we have across Minnesota. And what I have come to believe is we really need a very diverse range of types of services so people have choice. And so I think as we're going to see a lot of innovation in between the different kinds of services we've traditionally had available for people in community. And I hope that that continues so that people have a lot of choice about how they might want to live as they age or as people with disabilities want to live out in community. So I hope we see a lot more of that.
Mr. Chair, I would call it full spectrum, senior citizen, whether you care or however you want to do it, but I think we need to have an actual area that we, look at. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Harpstead, for being here today. So two quick things. First, we talked a little bit earlier in the day about emergency departments and some of the challenges that they are facing. And of course, I think it's difficult to predict the incredible confluence of factors that we're seeing in some of those departments. I know I've been working with Hennepin Health as well as North Memorial and talking with them a great deal and some of the challenges there. You have a number of patients who may actually fall under DHS services who are still residing in some of those emergency departments because we have nowhere for them to go and leading to some other challenges. But also we throw into that MAC of incredible surges or upticks in various illnesses, particularly this time of year. Then you have staffing shortages and so forth, which make it very complex. I am actually meeting with some folks today on that matter, so would love it to keep informed on your progress with that. I am a big also believer in process improvement, and I know that you internally have been doing a great deal of work along that line. That brings me to my other thing. I, of course, am also in the IT industry, do a lot around process improvement and work as a project manager, work with agile teams. So I really appreciate the idea of how we have to be a little bit more nimble in the future. We've talked a lot today about some of the financial challenges that we have, filling those FTEs, whether it be staffing concerns, fitting the right bodies for the right jobs, the dollars not stretching as far as they need to, and having to use some of those dollars to cover operational expenses. But that leads to the idea of how do we act a little bit more nimbly, a little bit more lean. So, for example, in Min Benefits, we were able to team up with Minute to streamline some of the paperwork and the application process for a lot of families and cut that process that took nearly an hour, just a little under, to about 12 minutes on average. That's an incredible savings. But the other part of that flip side of that coin that we haven't talked about is it also creates a great cost savings for staff when they have to process all of those applications. So I think that there are ways that we can work smarter and not harder and leaner by having those partnerships, by doing modernization and doing more, looking for more projects like Min Benefits within the department to make life a little easier for staff so they can ease their workload. And hopefully that will help staff to keep up and feel like they can tread water. So I would also encourage, and I will put this out there, I am one of sort of the de facto members of our head of the IT caucus here in the House and work closely with our Senate partners. And if there are any additional items, I know we have one in DCT right now that we're working on with you, but if there are other ideas that come forward or evolve over time, I would be delighted to be a part of the process to help you get those vetted and make sure that we're doing what we can to improve the situation on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any comments, Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Noor and Representative. We came forward last year with a proposal to just increase the investment in general of our service transformation work. This year we're coming forward with a proposal that has ideas in it that will have payoffs in the next year or two, and very excited to show you that once we have it out in the world.
Looking forward to that. Representative Francis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Harfstedt, could you just clarify for me? So when Representative Gilman asked about the best place for all children, and you said that at first, initially, you said it was when they were born. That's when you considered. And Representative Noor then mentioned it starts with a healthy pregnancy. Is it when the child's in utero, when it starts with a healthy pregnancy in utero, that is the best place for all children, that we want to make Minnesota the best place for all children, including, you know, the unborn in the utero, or is it when they are born? I just want on record clarification, because I'm hearing two different things, so I just want to hear from you.
Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Representative, we don't have a bright line of definition of that whole question in our work, and we certainly don't in a broad piece like a big possibility. So I don't have a definition of exactly when we talk about children's services starting in DHS. I'll have to give that some thought.
So you don't know if it starts in the womb or after the child's born? You have to give that thought?
Commissioner.
Yeah. Yeah, Chair Noor and Representative, we don't have a definition of okay. when our children's services begin in DHS.
Okay, thank you. And then follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you for indulging me. So back to the VBR, and I'm glad that we had this overview today on that payment system, because I, too, am hearing from my nursing home administrators, and I just recently had a meeting just before session started with the caretakers of Canute Nelson, and it was regarding the payment system being about 20 months behind and the issues that has created and just staffing issues itself. And so I implore this committee to take a deep dive into that sector. Before the VBR was put into place, many of you will remember that the payment system was a little different, and
at that time when I first got elected, it was the nursing homes were coming to us saying, you know, we got our caretakers are competing with McDonald's wages, and it was easier to go work at McDonald's or fast food or Walmart or Target than it was to do the caretaking that they went to school for and the job that they had. The VBR, when we passed that, they were very happy. I remember that. And now we're back into that same spot again where the administrators and the caretakers are coming to us and saying, listen here, we are short-staffed. We got people that are now contemplating leaving to go work again at Culver's that is hiring for $18, $19 an hour, right? And to hear the stories from the caretakers, it is heartbreaking. You walk away from there and you just feel so sad. And we're talking about people that truly love the work that they do, and they're picking up extra shifts. They're doing what they have to do to make sure that the residents are getting the care that they need. Mm-hmm. I also heard from another individual that was a very punitive fine that came through DHS for something super duper minor. And I asked that individual how she felt knowing that it was her little teeny tiny mistake that caused the fine that came from DHS to the nursing home. And she said she felt sick. Like, it was devastating for her morale. Obviously, the workforce didn't take it out on her. But that morale that she went home, you know, from this little teeny tiny mistake that DHS walked through and was like, oh, yep, I'm writing you up today, because they don't seem to leave the facility until they have a ticket in hand saying, well, nursing home, you didn't follow this rule, so here's your little fine and see you later. So something has to change. And once again, thanks for this, and I really do hope that this committee is the reason why I'm on this committee, is for the nursing homes, honestly. And those caretakers, they deserve better than what they're getting right now.
Thank you, Representative. Commissioner, did you
want to comment? Chair Noyan and Representative, just to be clear, the fine probably came from the Department of Health that does the licensing for our nursing homes. We take care of the payment to the nursing homes for Medicaid.
So we have Representative Zelensnicka, and then we'll go to Representative Kiel for the last question. So please.
Thank you, Chair Noyan, and I'll be quick. Thank you, Commissioner. As a nursing home administrator, I've been asked by many, this value-based reimbursement is, you're correct, 18 to 24 months behind. So we're at the end of 22, we're starting 2023, we're in 2023. How many nursing homes have not received their rates right now in the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner.
Chair Noren, Representative, I don't have the exact number. Everyone is receiving an estimated rate based on the overall rates, looking at the homes that we've completed their cost report studies on. There are some cost reports that are outliers, higher or lower than the average, that we're still looking at. But everyone is receiving the average estimated rate right now while we finish looking at the outlying rates to see if they might actually get some more during the year.
Follow-up, Representative Sylvester.
Thank you, Chair Noor. The question I'm hearing from nursing home operators is there are many, and I don't know the number, that are falling in this outlier category of the estimate, and they're in audit still. So if it's going past 24 months, which it has for them, that what is the completion date for these facilities? How long does it stay in this limbo of an audit being completed, because they're not going to have a final rate for whatever their costs incurred were?
Commissioner.
I'm not exactly sure. We will see how long it takes the people to finish the analysis. During before COVID, we used to have all the cost reports in and audited before the beginning of the year. The facilities asked us during COVID to give them a longer time to turn in their cost reports, which we started to do. This is the first year where we're catching up and starting an estimated payment in the very beginning of the year and then finishing the final cost reports to see if someone is actually going to get more. But all of them received approximately a 10% increase at the beginning of 2023.
Are there any facilities that... I'm sorry. Chair, no, Chair, I just had a follow-up.
Final one, please.
Are there facilities that are waiting, that are still waiting, that would be substantially beyond 24 months to get a rate increase? And do we know how many of them are in that category?
Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Representative, I don't know sitting here today. I would have to go ask my staff. But I think it's a minority. I have to go check.
Thank you, Commissioner. You. Hopefully we'll get more detail on some of the VBR, also the backlog. Representative Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, two things. One, kind of piggybacking on what Representative Franzen said, it's interesting to me that in one area of work, DHS will find a small concern and have a fine. And in another area, we can have counties completely out of compliance and we still give them money. So we'll just leave that there. But the other thing, as we kind of move forward in understanding seniors and the fact that it's statute, that it's age 65 plus, in my world, we look at it more as like our life cycle. And being an elder is your end stage of life, keeping in mind here that the average death of Native American men is 64 years old. So we're not even like, we're not even providing elder or end of life services for a population that data will continue to tell us we're not serving accurately. And so I know there's statutes and it's 65, but I would really encourage us as we move into this elder care conversation that some elders don't, I mean, my population, my dad died before he would have ever been classified as a senior and really needed some of these services. So just keeping in mind that it's not all populations that have these really long life expectancies, that services for seniors start at 65, that if we could take an approach that for some communities, and when I've looked at maps, there doesn't look like there's a whole lot of elder support in tribal communities, which maybe that's why. I just feel like I couldn't pass up kind of making that connection. I love the littles. That's usually where my lane goes. So like now in the elders, there's kind of a different age capacity. So just keeping in mind that maybe that's an area that we need to be mindful of. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Kill. I think there's a lot to digest there, and there's a lot more work for us to do. And we've got a, you know, more time to work on those issues. Commissioner, your final statement before we close for the day.
No, I'm all set. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Members, on Thursday we have a hearing on the homelessness package, and looking forward to seeing your House File 444. And we also have another bill, so we've got two bills on Thursday. With that, we are now adjourned.